You're listening to the HyberCloud Podcast, where the forecast here is always compelling as we discuss real-life challenges, successes, and stories from the journey to HyberCloud with your host, Andre Tost.
All right, welcome, and thanks everyone for joining this episode of the HyberCloud Forecast Podcast. Today, I'm happy to welcome Naeem Altas to our show. Thanks a lot for coming, Naeem.
You're most welcome. Thanks for having me.
So Naeem is an IBM Distinguished Engineer, but he also has like the coolest job title I can possibly think of because he's the CTO of SpaceTech for IBM. Obviously, something we want to talk about a bit more today. So let's just start out with the usual introduction. So if you could tell us a bit about your job history, background, and kind of leading into what you do today for IBM.
This year, around August time frame, it will be 23 years in IBM. So this is my first job, and I have a computer science background. Last 5-6 years ago, I got the opportunity to work on the NASA FDL, which is a Frontier Development Lab. It's an incubation program with SETI Institute. So I worked with them, and that inspired me to work towards more towards the space, because at first we think that, you know, to work in this industry, you have to be maybe an aerospace engineer or aeronautical in a background. But as we all know, that most of these industries, they, you know, there's computer software everywhere, software-defined solutions. So there's a room for people who are programmers, computer scientists, to be part of this industry. And that's how I came into, you know, working into the space tech.
So in other words, you're not a rocket scientist.
Not yet. Background originally from Pakistan. So I finished my high school and came here to study computer science at UT Austin. And after graduating, you know, been working at my first job.
So tell us a bit more about what you do. You just started going into, you know, it's all about the software. It's all about programming and software development and so forth. I have to be honest with you. I have very little understanding of what space tech actually means. How is it different from, you know, working on any other kind of application type?
Actually, there are many similarities. So if we, let's take example of, probably everybody have heard of the International Space Station. So International Space Station is a joint effort by many countries. And if you think in simple words, it's like a orbiting lab up there in the orbit. So there are many experiments which goes on behind those. Of course, you have the computing power and different programs running. So it's just very similar. The conditions are, of course, more harsh in which these, this compute and different hardwares have to operate in. And then the challenges with the network connectivity. So it's similar in many ways, but it's a, like I say, I try to call it like it's a edge computing nodes, but it's a extreme use cases for edge computing because of challenges like network connectivity. You don't have a 24/7 either connectivity just like we have on the terrestrial networks. So from that point of there is some challenges, but other than that, there's many similarities between what we do on terrestrial networks and what we should be able to do in the next edition of space stations.
So do they have internet connection up there?
Yes, they do. And the way internet connectivity works in case of space station, because it's orbiting in the low Earth orbit, and you have multiple orbits. You have low Earth orbit, you have middle Earth orbit, you have the geostationary orbit. And that's the orbit which is in sync with your location because it's rotating at the same speed at where the Earth rotates. So the way these things work, they beam data up from the low Earth orbit to the geostationary orbit satellites. And from there, the data gets beamed to the ground stations. So it's a another simple example is analogy is like if you have a dish network or, you know, some dish at home, you're watching the TV. Imagine if it was connecting to satellites in low Earth orbit. You have to go run out and keep on adjusting your dish so it can point to the antenna, or you will have intermittent disruption because there is no connection. But with geostationary, you are in sync. You're locked into that satellite. That's how, you know, data is moved from the low Earth orbit down to the Earth. Of course, there will be latency delays. And these are the challenges working with the stuff in space.
Okay, but that basically means that the astronauts working there, they can check their emails on their laptops like they would be anywhere else, pretty much.
Definitely, yes.
And they have laptops.
They do have laptops. They have servers. And, you know, for the next version of, because ISS will be out of commission by 2030. So there are multiple companies who got the contracts to put the next space station. So you will have the state-of-the-art facilities in the space station, because they will be built multi-purpose, not just for one. So, you know, because if you think about it, if you're putting a multi-billion dollar facility in space, it should serve multiple purposes. Besides, your, you know, whatever you're trying to do for your scientific research, you can also have spare hours of that space station for leisure, for traveling, all these different, for different kinds of experimentation, open it up to the public so they can do their experimentation. So there are many options available.
Okay. I'm wondering, you said they have servers up there and it's an extreme case of edge computing, so to speak. I would assume that, I guess, primary focus is on collecting data. And I guess I'm wondering what kind of data is that? But then is it primarily collecting that data and then sending it down to Earth, so to speak, for further processing? Or what kind of processing happens locally on the space station?
The answer is yes and yes, both. So, for example, there are many experiments which happens on space station, like DNA sequencing or growing plants, different kinds of experiments. So one of the research projects which we were able to work with ISS National Labs and NASA was about DNA sequencing. So what the project was about, you know, they inside the surface of a space station, they take these samples from the surface and run through this DNA sequencer. And then it generates like, I think, half a terabyte of data, which needs to be examined and goes through different processes of sequencing. And we build the code, we containerize the code, just like how we build code today on the Prestium networks to push for our applications. And then in partnership with HPE, they had their servers there. We put actually a version of OpenShift on that platform. And we then run our containerized code to go through that whole, basically, sequencing of DNA, the raw data which came out. This whole process took roughly between 8 to 10 hours. But imagine if you have to downlink half a terabyte of data, and then it has to move through different, you know, whatever the logistics are. And by the time it reaches in the hands of the PI, which is a principal investigator at NASA, it's been several weeks. In this case, we were able to get the results like in less than 10 hours. That's the power of edge computing. And it's just a start. Because normally the data is pushed down and then it runs to data centers. But if we have compute, maybe we can do some filtering. We don't have to send unnecessary data to the ground because the bandwidth is very, very valuable between the space station and the ground station.
Okay. And you have IT operators basically working on that just like they would work in any data center. So you just mentioned, which I didn't know, by the way, is that they run OpenShift in there. That's kind of interesting. But so that takes care and maintenance and so forth by operators. And so there, but those operators, I assume, are on the ground.
Yes. The operators are on the ground because they have direct access, sort of like they can, you know, associate into the systems and they can go and manage. And if you have to update anything they need to do, they have full access. So we work through the operators to get our software. First, like anything, the software is installed on the ground on the systems and tested and go through all the checklists from NASA. And then when they were shipped up to the space station, then the operators take over and then we tell them and they go and do different kinds of functions.
Okay, so can they patch those systems remotely?
Yes, in some cases.
Doesn't really seem all that different from if you were, you know, doing this on Earth, so to speak.
That's the goal, yes. That's definitely going forward. And in this case, the system, because we hear about space is a very harsh environment. We have a ruggedized, you know, radiation hardened system, which is very true. But our goal is to put the off-the-shelf compute because there are still challenges, right? When you have the proprietary systems, the whole stack which gets on top from operating system level to libraries, to what kind of platforms you will run and software development, that becomes more challenging because it seems like one-off things. But if you have the systems or platform which we as developers on the ground are working on, if we have the same system, then it's like it's a level field, right? Whatever I can develop there, I can push there. I don't have to have a special development for this proprietary system. And that's what we used and proved when running on HPE systems just and then using the OpenShift plan.
Let's talk a bit about the hardware. You just mentioned that. So what kind of servers are up there? Because you said, you know, those are very special conditions. I don't know, for example, is there plenty of power being generated or is that another consideration?
So the systems are Intel based, like off the shelf. So it's not like any proprietary. But of course, there is precautions taken in terms of to prevent, because the first test you have to pass is the vibration test. So when the systems are launching on the rocket, there's a huge amount of vibration. So you have to pass those vibration tests on the ground. And then it has to have some level of, you know, ruggedized systems. But the thing is, the space station is it's just enclosed inside the space station, right? So space station itself provides protection from radiation. Now that the case is different when we talk about doing some computation or computation on the satellite itself, because that over there, as you can imagine, the radiation hardening is probably much needed than maybe in the space station because of the environment over there. And then the challenges are, if you are in the space station, challenges around the power consumption and the heat dissipation. So those all things were considered by the, you know, the HPE team. Some of this information is probably it's confidential, but those, because there's a very strict checklist, which you have to go through from NASA, your systems to be validated, to be pushed up.
And you mentioned NASA, by the way. Isn't more and more of this work done? I mean, isn't it handed out to private companies like SpaceX, for example? Do you work with them at all, or is that a whole separate thread?
You're absolutely right. I mean, NASA has opened up a lot in last, I would say, 3 to 5 years. And, you know, you see SpaceX, actually, I think this weekend, on Friday, SpaceX did 2 launches in a day. Within 4 hours. If you remember back in the 80s, 90s, you probably used to have, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 space shuttle launches in a 1 year. Now, the SpaceX is doing almost every week or every other week. That is because they're building the, you know, the Starlink constellation, they provide internet connectivity. So yes, NASA is partnering with all these private companies to move forward faster. And you have seen, like, we probably have, I think, 4 or 5 astronauts going through the SpaceX Dragon space station. We also had the general public going up on the SpaceX rocket. So there is a lot of innovation happening now where NASA is reaching out to all these partners, because I think we can move much more faster with them. And SpaceX has definitely changed again.
So what is IBM's contribution to all this? You said we're providing things like OpenShift, some application environment. Anything more specific? I mean, like, so I guess we're not on the hardware side of this. We're on the software side of this, if I understood what you said.
Yes, that's correct. So what our vision and contribution, as we are discussing with various forums in the space industry and companies. So IBM, we have this... Our vision is about hybrid cloud platform. What hybrid cloud platform meant was basically no matter, you know, where you are, because we understand that many of our companies and partners and, you know, customers, they all are running in different places. For example, if you look at the spectrum, you have developers on their laptops, maybe sitting in Hawaii on the beach doing their work. And then, you know, the companies they work for, they have their own data centers. The companies also have, they extend their data centers into multi-cloud because they don't want to be, you know, they are working with different cloud vendors. They don't want to be locked in. So this is an era of openness, right? It's everywhere. Open source, openness of platforms. And then they have their edge, you know, depending upon if you're a telco industry, you have your edge sites, or if you have bank, all your remote locations are your edge sites. And then working on the same principles, we extend the edge to space. So if we have a space station or a satellite capable of doing computation, the idea is this hybrid platform, which is built on top of OpenShift, that's the IBM support strategy. Example, imagine if the, you know, OpenShift is running on space station or the future space stations or some smaller flavor of OpenShift running on the satellite, which we are running we'll talk about that, our CubeSat. So if I'm a developer, I write a code, I containerize my code, now I want to push this code to my target. The target can be a data center, can be a cloud, can be an edge site, and can be somewhere in the orbit, in space. From a developer's point of view, I don't have to worry about the underlying platform now because it's all the same wherever I'm pushing the code. All I have to worry about is whatever code I'm writing for that particular, you know, problem you're trying to solve. So that's our main strategy. And we just took one more step to say, okay, can this platform be extended to the orbit?
That makes sense. Now, you mentioned, so IBM, say, you know, we're the company of the hybrid cloud. We're also the company of AI, obviously, which is, you know, getting a lot of attention right now in the media with, you know, latest developments in AI. It's going to be easy to imagine that also influences applications that run like in a space station, because I think the gist of what you're saying is that it's not that much different. It just happens to be in a different place. So I assume that extends into the area of AI as a way of analyzing data, for example, that is becoming really common.
Yes, totally agree. And the thing is, the data AI goes together and sensors, right? So wherever there is sensors, data is being produced. Wherever there is data, you need AI, some form of AI to deal with that data. And now, you know, we are seeing many different flavors of AI. Machine learning, deep learning, generative AI, right? There's so much stuff happening around. I hope the people are following up, you know, what happened with the GPT, GPT-4, this new, the foundation models. So yes, so they play a huge role. So for example, think of a space station as a facility, right? The space station has its components, which are actually doing two purposes. One is to keep the space station orbiting up there. All those mechanisms, the machinery involved in that, those are systems, the SCADA systems, or all those PLCs, which are actually maintaining the space station. Then there are systems or computation, which are doing different kinds of running workloads. So all of these things are producing enormous amount of data. Now the thing is, okay, because as you all know, the data has a very short life when you want to act on that data. It's a very short, the window of opportunity is very small. If you miss that window and say, okay, I'll take care of this alert maybe 3 hours from now, it can be very, it can be a disaster. So you have to act on that alert on data when you receive that immediately. And there's the whole essence of edge computing. And that's where AI comes into picture. Now with all these foundation models, we just announced a month ago a collaboration with NASA around foundation models. What is a foundation model, right? Basically, a foundation model is, you're building a generic model, and the people who are you know, familiar with these deep learning models, if you know the YOLO stuff, basically you build a model with generic stuff which knows about A to Z, and then, you know, the model is built with an enormous amount of data. Now, for example, if I want to use a foundation model for, let's say, I'm looking at a particular sensor on space station, then I will take that model and use that data to build on top of that. I don't have to start from scratch when I'm building these AI models. I think that's where the industry is heading towards, because to build a base, it takes enormous amount of computation. So if the big companies, you know, are taking care of that, the application users can build on top of that for their applications. And same thing, which I think will happen for many industries, and same for the space, where we take these foundation models and the data which is being generated, we use AI models, get the HTML insights.
Can you give an example of a concrete application maybe that you've been working on or influencing that uses all of these systems that you just described, like a concrete application that's running up there right now?
So one example I mentioned earlier was the DNA sequencing that is running up there. Basically, like we mentioned, right, because we want to think about, I don't know, 10, 15 years from now, or probably in the end of this decade, that, you know, the planned Artemis program, where we plan to put men on the moon, men and women on the moon, and this time to stay there and create bases over there so we can go to the next, to Mars. So if you are there and, you know, you're worried about the astronauts' health, that's the most important thing, and you take some samples and you're trying to, or maybe you're trying to discover some life, right? You want to take some samples, you want to run these samples through this DNA sequencer and get the results. You don't want to wait for all the data to be pushed back to the terrestrial networks on the ground and then do computation, come back with results. It can be a long time. So going back to your question, where you mentioned that we have this, what's the concrete example? The concrete example one is the DNS sequencing, which is running right now, taking samples. And the other example which you can talk about is the CubeSat, which we launched last year, which is doing edge computing as well.
I guess where I'm coming from, and I apologize if this sounds a bit silly, but there's this TV show, The Big Bang Theory, right? And there's one of my favorite shows, and there's this one engineer named Howard, and he always says he designed the toilet seat for the space station. So I guess you have the equivalent of that, in the DNS sequencing application, maybe. Do you ever get to touch any of these things? I mean, do you ever go onto the NASA grounds? And obviously, Austin is not very far from Houston, which is why I assume they have a big center. Do you ever get to like talk to the astronauts, or is that, are you one level removed from that kind of thing?
No, I have directly talked to astronauts on the ground as well as on the space station. So we did that last year. And just recently, we had announced a collaboration with Sierra Space. So like I mentioned, that there were three companies who got the contracts to put the next generation of space station. Sierra Space is one of them. And we are working with them, printing some prototypes. And so I was lucky there to visit their facilities in Denver, and where they have their spaceship is ready to be launched, I think, or to test it at least this year. So I was able to go into the manufacturing facility and actually see the spaceship. So yes, I tried to get, last year when the SLS, the Artemis program, I got some last minute invitation to come and see the launch in Florida. So I just put my family in the car and we drove 15 hours straight, and we reached there just, I think, 2 hours before the launch. And then the launch was scrubbed, and then we sat back in the car, had lunch, and came back for an hour. So I traveled almost like 2,400 miles in less than 2 days. I was back home. So, sometimes we get the opportunity.
Was it worth it?
It was worth it. At least, you get to see stuff. At least for me, the kids, I think, but at least for me, to go and see inside the facilities at NASA, in Florida, that was the first time going there and seeing the SLS rockets so close. So that was pretty cool.
I also have to ask, because my daytime job is in cybersecurity. So I have to ask, kind of, how does that influence the work that you do? I assume that something like a space station is a potential target with potentially catastrophic consequences if things go bad. So how big of a role does that play?
No, that's a very critical piece, Lawrence. Especially there's a lot happening in the space domain. So you probably hear about this space situational awareness. And you hear about space debris. There's a lot of these things happening. Plus, we also hear about the constellations which will go up from satellites, and then the optical connection from the ground station to the satellites. So the technology industry is going very fast. And that also opens up for a lot of opportunities for the bad actors, right, from security point of view. Because the segment is from your data station to ground station, that's one segment. From ground station to your satellite, that's another segment. So you have to have security and encrypted information going all the way, because there's various techniques, and especially when you are in the battlefield, the information is very critical. So yeah, there's a lot happening, and it will be very interesting, especially when this concept of constellation, for example, the things we talk about, GDPR and all these things, the boundaries of data cannot move. What if you have a constellation in the orbit, and you beam data up from one part of Asia, right? And now you can push that data in a constellation to the satellite, and now you're sitting in North America and you can do a downlink. What happened to all those boundaries of GDPR? How do you control them? So I think these are the next set of challenges which will come. But right now it's a very hot topic. And just one last thing about space situational awareness is, like, because there's so many, like, up till 3-4 years ago, we only had like close to 9,000 satellites put in the orbit and 5,000 were active. And now with all these constellations and this new phenomenon of trying to provide internet connectivity from the low Earth orbit, SpaceX and Kuiper program, they all plan to put up around like 30 to 40,000 satellites in this decade alone. So just imagine what will happen there. And how do you know, like when you are in the space, how do you know who is around me? Because the US is not the only one. The China and other countries who are coming up, they want to put their stuff in the low Earth orbit as well. So now it will be very interesting to see, you know, who is watching me, who is there, who is trying to hack in the orbit. These all challenges do come up in the next few years.
Is there a lot of collaboration on things like standards or, I don't know, the word that came to my mind, is there some kind of global air traffic control for space, you know, space traffic control or other things like that? I mean, how's that being handled? Like you said, when the Chinese want to put something up and the Americans put something up, how do they make sure they don't run into each other all the time?
They call it space traffic management, STM. And yes, they are. So mostly this is dealt by the Air Force of each country, like Russian or NATO or US. But the interesting part is, and the data is not, it is not really shared. It's not accurate. So for example, if we are at the control tower at the airport and a flight is coming from New York to Austin, and all of a sudden, the report I get, I see four different paths of that same flight. That's going to be, so I don't know which of those four paths is correct, or which is given to me. Same thing is happening right now, because all these agencies, they have their own data, which is not fully shared. So if you look at the map, which US shows what's in the orbit, which NATO shows, which Russian shows, they all have a different map. So if you're a control tower person and you want to track one object, you will see at least 3 to 4 different paths of that object. And that is a huge challenge. So yeah, I think the only way this is going to get solved is that they have to work together at some national, you know, international policy level. There are organizations, but, you know, they will have to work together to resolve this. Otherwise, it can be very challenging because there's so much stuff being put in the orbit almost every week now.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are at about time here now, but I don't want to let you go without asking my final question that I always ask, which is, can you tell us to the degree that you can share, of course, kind of something really exciting that you're working on right now that makes you want to, you know, get up in the morning and get to work, something that is really cool that is kind of in your space right now?
First of all, you know, as you well know also, Andrew, as DEs at IBM and any other companies, we wear multiple hats. So one hat is where, you know, I have the daily job as we work on the cloud and we work with the world's largest financial institutions. That's the primary job. But on the side, we are also doing a lot of innovative projects. And one of the projects which we started a couple of years ago was we launched IBM's first satellite, Cube Satellite. And the way we came about that, when the space tech program was created by our president at that time, Jim Whitehurst, our goal was, okay, how can we put our satellite in the orbit? And being very naive and, you know, not a background from aerospace, I thought I can do a 3D printed Vela CubeSat, put some compute inside, and we'll call NASA and say, "Dude, can you please put this in the orbit?" But it's not sort of the case. Actually, there's a very interesting NASA 101 guide for CubeSat, which everybody should read. It's more than 100 pages. It goes in details how you can build a satellite and launch it. And it's a lot of, it's very complex, especially from the logistics point of view. So when we learned all that, it was like, okay, if it's so challenging for us living in this modern world to launch a satellite, it's almost like straight possible for the developing nations to put something in the orbit. So our mission was, if we are successful in putting the CubeSat in orbit, we will open it up to all the schools in the world. So basically democratize the access to space. So all in children everywhere in the schools, different parts of the world, we let them write Python code and we will push their code up to the CubeSat where we have the Raspberry Pi running on CubeSat. And it can interact with the camera, it can do different kinds of computation and give them back the results. IBM has a B P-Tech program, and we have right now 5 schools enrolled who are working right as of right now to send push their code to the CubeSat. So this is one of the very exciting things I'm doing. And besides, thinking about how we build the hybrid space platform.
Very cool. That actually made me curious to learn more about. So I'm gonna have to find a link. In fact, I think if there is a link, we might add it to the description for this episode so people can actually look it up. With that, then we're gonna wrap it up for today. I want to thank you for all this insight. This was amazing. As is often the case with these podcasts, like when I'm done, I'm thinking I should switch jobs. I should do what my guests are doing because it sounds really exciting. And so maybe I need to look into a job in space tech. That's kind of a really cool thing. All right. Thanks again for coming today.
Thank you for having me.
With that, we're going to wrap it up. Thank you all for listening, and I hope to see you soon. Bye-bye.